Chapter 15. We arrived back at Platform Prime 6 hours later, hyperjumping into the airspace above Detritus and flying in formation, and my cockpit was even more crammed than normal when we did, because I'd brought back two new pilots, in the shape of two large crystals, each roughly the size of a flight helmet.
"Is this it?"
Shiver asked, her voice a crystalline peal vibrating from her core.
"Is this your home?"
"Yes," I said. "You can't see it?" I'd never quite figured out how a chunk of crystal, a creature known as a resonant, could see.
"I require instruments to see through a vacuum," Shiver explained. "All I can see right now is the cockpit."
"Currently, Shiver,"
Hesho said, describing it as we got docking permissions.
"We're approaching a large space station, flat and shaped kind of like a large rectangle, that hovers in orbit around the planet Detritus. It is one of hundreds that orbit the planet, the place where Spensa was born, and the place that is now our home."
At that word, the second of the two resonants, Deliz, projected some thoughts. She was cytonic and had fared poorly during her time in the nowhere, growing quiet, withdrawn, even mentally broken. But today she projected images of happiness, rest, and satisfaction to me.
"Home,"
she said, the word vibrating from her core from just behind my seat.
"Home," Doomslug fluted. "She's feeling better," Shiver said. "Deliz is already feeling better. I resonate with satisfaction, Spensa. Coming to the somewhere is what she's needed, as I always thought."
I didn't say anything, as I wasn't so certain as Shiver. Deliz had communicated like this with me before. Still, the two resonants had long wanted to escape the nowhere, and so I decided to make good on my promise. Maxim, another good friend from the other side, had opted to stay for now. Peg and her team were going to need every ship they had for the task I'd given them. Fortunately, they had a few extra pilots to take over Shiver's and Deliz's ships. "If Deliz wants to go straight home to your caverns," I said, "I'm sure we can find a ship to take the two of you back to your planet."
"No, no," Shiver said. "If we go home right away, that will only alert the authorities who banished us to the nowhere in the first place. Perhaps sometime in the future, but for now, we don't want to be a burden. I am certain we can find something to do."
It took a little longer than normal to be contacted by the flight deck as we waited to land. Finally, Hill, one of the flight operators, called us.
"Sorry for the delay, Skyward Flight," he said. "Admiral Waite wanted to be here to greet you when you returned from your secret mission. He's on his way."
Secret mission, eh? I steeled myself, but passed the time by reaching out cytonically to the ship hovering next to mine. Kimmelin's ship, which carried the rescued slugs. "You have a friend," I sent to that slug. "She wanted me to save you. Can you contact her?" One of the newly rescued hyperslugs replied with impressions of many slugs in cages, of a dark and frightening place, of thousands upon thousands of thoughts bombarding them, shoving against one another, being sorted and sent out. "The communications hub," I sent. "Yes, I know." Though the awful sensation was stronger than I'd realized, I did know about this place. "How can I reach her?" "Sorrow," followed. The slug didn't know how. The comm slug reached out to others, sometimes to comfort them in their captivity, but only when she was scheduled to contact the supply depot for another reason. It was like she smuggled them empathy along with the data stream she was required to send. Scud. I didn't know how the communications hub worked, only that through some mechanical means, the superiority could force comm slugs into slavery, allowing the planets to talk to one another. And I realized we'd never rescued a comm slug. Apparently, they were kept under even tighter wraps than the hyperslugs who teleported ships. That made some sense. These were the only ones that could work remotely, so why not keep them all in one secure place? Again, the superiority proved its paranoia and willingness to rely on a few highly important facilities. I needed to find a way to get to that slug. I'd promised her I would, but it might take until the superiority itself was dismantled. So I put the problem aside for now. Any update from Peg? I sent to Embot, hopeful as I waited in my cockpit.
Not yet, he replied.
We'd waited as long as we could for her to proceed before returning to Detritus. That, however, had obviously given Jorgen plenty of time to find out what we'd done. We finally got permission to land, and I led the ships into the hangar we'd left hours ago. I immediately spotted Jorgen in the long window overlooking the flight deck. He stood in a brilliant white uniform, hands clasped behind his back, metal shining on his breast. Face like stone. Yeah, I deserved that. As we climbed from our ships, I asked the others to take the two resonants and show them around the place, then see if we could get them quarters. I told the team that I would talk to Jorgen. He didn't move to stop them as they scampered away. I walked up to the window, and though I didn't hear him bark the command, I could see the technicians inside the room flooding out the back doors. Jorgen remained standing in place, waiting. Well, I'd picked this fight. I would approach it with a warrior's dignity. I used the side door, stepping into the ops room, which was now empty save for Jorgen. I strode right up to him, then waited for my dressing down. Silence. He just stared out at our ships, giving me time to sweat, a time-tested tool in the commander's toolbox. I let the silence hang. I was confident I'd done what needed to be done.
I thought I knew what it would cost, Jorgen finally said.
He rested a gloved hand on the glass.
That's why I fought it.
Sir? I asked.
I thought that maybe if I flew well enough, he continued, they'd let me remain a pilot. Let me stay on that side of the glass. Smell the engines, feel the hum of the ship, hear the chatter of my friends. Then I was needed.
He closed his eyes.
I figured I could escape any order that tried to force me out of the cockpit. But I was wrong. Because I eventually got one I couldn't ignore from my own conscience.
He opened his eyes and looked at me, finally.
So here I am, on this side of the glass. Maybe forever. It ripped me apart to walk away from my ship, knowing that, by taking command, I was giving up something I loved. I didn't fully understand, though. I didn't realize I'd stop being one of you and would become the thing you resent.
We don't resent you, Jorgen.
You do, and you always have, he said. I was jerkface from the start. But at least I was with you. I was one of you, even if I was the one you grumbled about.
He sighed.
I knew I was giving up my dreams of flying. I didn't know I was giving up my friends, too.
Scud. This was fighting dirty. I was supposed to be the one who did that. Jorgen, I said, stepping closer. I didn't mean to. Do you understand what it does to my authority when you, of all people, disobey me? He snapped.
When you treat these bars on my shoulders like they aren't worth the cloth they're made of. You undermine me, Spensa. From the first day we met, you've always undermined me.
I fell silent. He was hurting. I could feel it radiating from him like heat from a forge.
I've tried so hard to ignore it, he said. I know your background. I know how you were treated because of your father. I know you have a problem with authority, and I try not to take it personally. But damn you, Spensa. Can't you at least try to show some respect? If not for my position, then for me? You come to my rooms, treat me like someone you love, then you do this? How am I supposed to react? What do you want from me?
I did this for you, I said. I saw how the decisions were tearing you apart, and I wanted to protect you.
You don't get to make that choice, he shouted, waving a hand at the ships. That's what military discipline is all about. Come come and tell me if there's a problem. Talk to me about it. Don't hijack my most decorated pilots and go off on a scudding rogue mission. Don't put me in a position where I have to either discipline my friends or accept that I have no authority.
They insisted on coming, I said.
I didn't want... Is that relevant?
He demanded.
You did it, even if you didn't want to.
And you went against Stoff's authority in taking command, I shouted back at him. Because you felt like you had to. Well, I felt I had to do this. He put his hand to his face, trying to wipe off some of the sweat, and turned away from me, looking out at the ships again.
The enemy has reinforced every strategic position, he said. All of the supply depots except the one you struck have been protected with dozens of ships, and likely an equal number of inhibitors. We'll never attack them successfully now. I've called off the strike.
You won't need it anyway, I said. He narrowed his eyes, his face reflected faintly in the glass in front of him.
What did you do?
I contacted the broadsiders, I said. The pirates on the other side of those portals. For a small payment, ships we stole, they agreed to attack the mining installations from the other side. If my guess is right, Winzik will have left the installations vulnerable on that side, bringing ships through to our side to reinforce his position. If Peg and her teams lock the portals from the other side, then no acclivity stone can come through. It's just as effective as destroying the installations on this side, but won't require nearly as many resources from us, or as much death. The mining stations on the other side will give in easily. They're not soldiers. They're mostly prisoners. With some careful work from Peg, I'm sure they'll fold quickly, without loss of life.
And you didn't suggest this to me because...
Because you'd have found it too risky, I said. You told me we couldn't rely on a group of pirates led by a former superiority officer. If I'd told you my plan, you'd have rejected it and insisted on attacking the installations, blowing them up, cities and all, to be safe. And it would have ripped you apart, Jorgen.
And isn't that my choice to make? What's the point of having leaders, a chain of command, if you just ignore it when convenient?
I didn't respond because he was right. I'd always had this problem. I'd always dreamed of being a warrior. Being a soldier was something else entirely. Then again, the military complex hadn't given me much reason to put my faith in it, not even with someone I cared about in charge.
You really believe you can trust them? Jorgen asked softly. That they won't sell us out?
I know it for a fact, I said.
And will it work?
He asked.
These pirates of yours, they can execute a large-scale raid like this?
We should know soon enough, I said. Traveling takes a while in the belt, as they can't hyperjump, but the other mining installations are closer than I'd thought. It's odd. I always wondered why they hadn't been spotted. Shorehold is a massive operation. Peg and the others should have had some understanding of where the others were.
You didn't expect them to be buried?
That was one of the revelations of the data dump. Most of the mining operations in the nowhere were happening inside the floating chunks of stone. Vast mining centers were chewing through the insides of the fragments, sometimes towing new ones over and eating them from within as well. It was a clever way to avoid the attention and the raids that Shorehold had drawn. Unfortunately for the superiority, that sort of operation also left the installations relatively unprotected once their location was known. I waited, nervous.
No news yet, M-Bot sent me. Hopefully soon.
She'd have to raid all four at once, I reminded myself, which meant that she couldn't attack until each of her four teams were in position. I didn't want her to rush, though each minute of delay made me increasingly uncertain. Had Winzik realized what we were doing and sent reinforcements through to protect the other side? Had something happened to Peg? There were still some pirates there who didn't support her leadership. If it fails, I'll take the blame, I whispered to Jorgen. You can tell everyone what I did.
That's the problem, he said, not looking at me as we waited. I can't. You're too much of a symbol, Spensa, and too important to our fight. We need every Cytonic, even if I have to spend part of my time during my command duties doing Cytonic work. I've already let it be known that you and I planned this in secret, as we were worried about leaks among our allies. That will weaken our relations with them, but it lets you go without consequences, whatever happens.
He paused.
I didn't do this because of my feelings. It's actually in the handbook. Disciplining the upper ranks needs to be handled carefully, lest we risk alienating forces loyal to any given admiral.
I don't want you to have to.
It's done, he snapped. And it's my decision to make. Unless you want to ignore even my ability to provide damage control for your recklessness.
Scud. I'd have gotten angry at that tone if I hadn't also been able to feel how much this was hurting him. Maybe this had been a step too far. It was just so hard to keep it all in. Suddenly, the world began to vibrate. Another episode had come for me. I threw everything I had into stopping it, trying to control myself. I wasn't a child to have a tantrum. But this episode didn't progress like the previous ones. I was struck with a sudden, overpowering sense of doom. I saw Jorgen dying beside me. I saw a shadow of him fall backward, bloodied, collapsing to the ground. It was like the visions I'd seen when reading the memories of the ancient Cytonics. I stifled a scream at the sight of him dead on the ground, blood pooling around his head, eyes staring, sightless. He was gone in a moment, but left me with an overpowering sense of loss and pain. It shook me deep into my core, and I was forced to wonder if it was some kind of terrible premonition. Cytonics couldn't see the future, could they? I felt my own unbearable pain resonating to me as if from another time, washing over me like a smothering darkness. I whimpered softly, teeth clenched. Jorgen looked at me and seemed concerned.
Spensa, Embot said, it's all right. Peg just sent word. All four installations have been claimed. It's like you said, they barely had anyone defending them. They were depending on being impossible to find, so they each surrendered quickly. Only at one of them were any shots even fired. Spensa?
It worked, I said to Jorgen. He let out a long sigh.
Well, thank the saints for that, I suppose. I'll let the others know. Perhaps our allies will forgive us for our lack of trust since the operation was successful.
And you? I said, feeling a lingering sense of agony.
That might take longer, he said softly. And it will depend on you, and how often you pull stunts like this. We can be a team, Spensa. Or I can just spend the rest of my life covering for you.
He turned and left me then. I managed to wait until he was gone, then sank to my knees, rocked by the sight of him dead, ignoring Embot's questions as I wrapped my arms around myself, trying to hold on and keep from cracking further. Chapter 16. I went on a walk. Growing up, that had been my go-to solution for any issue. There were endless caverns on Detritus, full of nooks to explore. I'd mapped as many as I could, enjoying the solitude, working through my anger at how society treated me. Maybe I should have focused a little more on what my anger was doing to me. I liked to think that all of my problems had come from how I'd been treated when I was younger, the way people thought of my father, and the bullying they'd shown me in turn. Their prejudice had made a fighter of me from a young age, yet even as a child, I'd often barreled forward, doing whatever I wanted without bothering to think what it might cost my friends and family. Walking had always helped. Today, I tried to find the same solace as I walked Platform Prime, asking the illuminated hallways to allow the same meditative peace I'd once found in dusty darkness. There were some similarities. The tight enclosures felt like tunnels, and they made unexpected turns with a variety of corners to explore. On Detritus, sometimes I'd take a path only to discover a cavern covered with quartz, glittering in the dim light. Here, I instead discovered a room full of blinking lights of a dozen varieties. I even found a rat hiding in a corner. What did it live on up here? How had it even gotten here? I left it alive, granting it a battlefield pardon, as one might a worthy foe. After all, this was either a rat from a population that had somehow survived for centuries up here, or it had managed to stow away on one of our ships. It was the Spensa version of a rat, hiding out among the enemy and gathering their secrets. The further I explored, entering areas of the platform that I hadn't even known existed, the more wondrous I found it. A swimming pool. An observation room where you could stand over the planet and look down at its surface as if you were hovering in the stratosphere. A room with dozens of tables, which looked like they were for games. The people who had lived here had played ping pong and billiards and other old Earth leisure activities that I'd only read about. The ancient humans had made time for games, for frivolity in ways we never had. For the first time in my life, I wondered what kind of world my children would grow up in. Would I have children? I'd always assumed I'd end up dead in battle before that happened. I'd make a terrible mom, wouldn't I? Spensa, Embot said in my head as I rounded one of the ping pong tables. I'd always preferred reading about baseball, where you used giant clubs instead of little paddles. Can we talk, please? Absolutely, I said, glad for a distraction from my own troubles. What's on your mind?
Well, I think you know, but I should say, I'm not actually a ghost. I'm quite the opposite. I'm more alive than I ever was in the somewhere, free from the constraints that forced me to think of myself as something false, allowed to steer my own destiny, capable of understanding and starting to manage my own emotions.
That sounds awesome, I said. You've come a long way. And I don't know if I thanked you properly for sacrificing yourself for me.
It turned out to be less of a sacrifice and more of an ascension.
Still, I said, you didn't know what would happen, and you did it anyway. After being angry at me for weeks for abandoning you, when it came time, you saved me.
I did. Didn't I? That sounds heroic, doesn't it?
Scud, yes.
That's terrifying, Spensa.
Wait, terrifying? I wandered out of the game room, back into a hallway.
Yes, terrifying. Spensa, I am no longer bound by programming. I no longer have an excuse. Before, I did what I was designed to do. Now I've acknowledged my free will. That means I have to worry about things I never did before. Things like morality.
I think you'll do fine, I said. The people who brood about their moral compass in stories tend to be the strongest at making decisions.
Really?
Yep. Well, them and the tortured anti-heroes. But I don't think that's you. You're a little too
noble.
Bubbly, I said. But also noble. Yeah, I probably should have just said noble.
You're a good person, Embot.
Person? I'm a person. That's strange when I don't even have a body. Is it wrong that I miss it? I couldn't control it, and the circuitry was literally designed to imprison me. But that ship was me. Mine. I miss it.
I tried not to feel guilty. I already had enough to feel bad about, remembering how I'd left him to be ripped apart, his ship dissected and then destroyed by the superiority wouldn't help. I'm sorry, I whispered.
It wasn't your fault. You didn't rip me apart. See? I understand that, and I feel it. But Spensa, I'm still worried. because of morality. I feel like I need to be helping you, protecting our friends, doing what I can from in here.
Great, I said. That's what I need you to do.
You are a huge help with Peg, and you're keeping an eye on the Delvers.
Not much to watch. Something's odd about them, Spensa. More odd, I mean. They're emerging from hiding, and while imitating one of them so they don't know what I am, I've been able to listen in on a few things. They've been talking to Winzik and Braid again. It seems the deal between the Delvers and the Superiority is still in force. A treaty.
I nodded, feeling daunted. But this was no more than what I'd expected. The Delvers were willing to work for Winzik in exchange for him promising to exterminate the Cytonics, me in particular, and to move to using slugs alone for hyperjumping. I didn't know how Braid fit into that deal. At any rate, if not for their timidity about me, Winzik would already have used them as a weapon against us. Worryingly, if the Delvers were still talking to him, it might not be long before they decided to move, regardless of their fear.
The Delvers are no longer willing to hide, Embot explained. I can feel them seething, trembling with emotion.
Keep an eye on them, I said. Let me know if you think they're about to move on from stewing about me to actually attacking us.
I will, but Spensa, do you mind me asking, why do you fight? Is it still for the chance to murder your enemies?
It was never about that. Not really, I said. It was about proving myself.
You did that, though, didn't you?
I supposed I had. Ever since I'd chosen to eject from my ship back in flight school, I hadn't worried if I was a coward or not. I'd proven myself, to myself. Why did I fight now?
It's for the reasons you gave earlier. For my friends, for my people. And at the end of it, what do you want?
I don't know, I said. I don't really think that far ahead.
I do, and that's what worries me. Spensa, everything in my existence was pushing me toward that moment when I decided, when I went against programming, self-preservation, and reason to protect my friends. I came of age in that moment, Spensa. Now that I'm the equivalent of an adult, shouldn't I want to do the right things? Shouldn't I enjoy what I'm doing because it's the proper choice, the moral one?
You don't enjoy it?
No. I'll do it, but I'd rather be doing something else.
Collecting mushrooms?
Yes. Or other things. Does it really matter if it's not the thing I should be doing?
I suppose it doesn't, I said. But Embot, if it helps, I don't think most people want to do what's right. That's what makes doing the right thing noble. It's a conscious choice, a hard one. If it were easy, then why would we respect it so much? I'd never phrased it that way before, not even to myself. Simple though the concept was, it struck me powerfully right then. I nodded, trailing through the hallway, walking, without consciously realizing it, back toward the observation room with the glass floor. I found an odd sense striking me as I walked the hallway. A familiarity, or maybe just a kinship. When I'd first come to these platforms, I'd found their sterile corridors to be too clean, too slick, too inorganic. I felt a little of that again now, but also something else. Huh, I said, resting my hand on the corridor wall. I'm actually growing to like this place. I would have thought I'd find it even more unnatural after traveling the landscapes of the fragments. Embot didn't respond immediately, and I felt an unusual disconnect from him. Embot? I sent.
Sorry, Embot said. What was that? Something about liking the corridors now?
Yes. Are you all right?
Yep. Just processing something. But I'm not surprised you find that place more homey than you once did. You've been away and returned. Humans are often nostalgic for the past. Plus, they form bonds of familiarity with the oddest objects and sensations. Says the robot who for some reason loves mushrooms, I said.
Hey, mushrooms are at least alive, and they're fascinating. So many varieties, growing in the harshest locations. Did you know some fungi can puppet the bodies of insects like zombies?
That's hardcore, I said. Who'd have thought mushrooms could be that cool?
But back to you being strange, Embot said. Maybe you just like those hallways because they remind you of a cockpit and of flying with me.
I loved that idea, though I didn't think it was accurate. Still, it made me smile as I continued walking, rounding the corner and stepping into the room with the glass floor. This time, though, it was occupied. A lanky young man with red hair lay on the floor, a bunch of schematics spread out around him, though he was lying face down and looking through the glass. Rig jumped when he heard me, looking up, then relaxed when he saw it was just me.
Hey, he said. Hear you had an exciting day.
Yeah, exciting, I yawned. Isn't it morning on standard schedule times? Shouldn't you be at breakfast? He said, then checked his watch.
I don't really care about schedules. I've been up all night anyway.
Rig, I said, hands on my hips. You spent years complaining when I woke you up, or kept you out, for one of my brilliant and interesting plans.
Fortunately, the windows here lead into a vacuum, he noted. So I don't get woken up by you rapping on mine, convinced we need to go hunting for lost treasure in yet another empty cavern.
I eventually found treasure, I'll have you know, I said, folding my arms. I expected Embot to pipe in at that, but he didn't. And when I nudged him satanically, he felt distant again. Was something going on with him? Anyway, I continued, I am offended by your suddenly deciding to stay up all night without me. He shrugged.
FM stays up late, so I found myself doing it more and more.
Of course, I said, walking over. Around Rig, I felt not immature, but more like my old self. I flopped down beside him on my back, ruffling a few of his schematics, and looked at the ceiling. Then I rolled over to look down like he was, through the glass toward detritus below.
Scud, I whispered. That's disorienting.
I know, right?
Rig said, excited. I feel like I'm falling, I said, staring down, like I'm plummeting toward the surface.
I feel like I'm floating, he said, like I get to see everything, take it all in for once. Maybe understand it, rather than being afraid of it.
You've been doing a pretty good job of not being afraid of things lately, I noted.
It's not that I'm not afraid, he said. It's that, well, I've got a good support structure. That helps.
Huh. That wasn't how I would have put it. As a kid, I'd have said that courage destroys fear. Now, I'd have said that fear is what lets us be able to be courageous. I'm glad that it's working with you and FM, I said, that you have a support structure, that you're no longer just that boy with the weird friend you can't get rid of.
Oh, please, he said. We both know that no one was pounding on my door demanding my friendship. You didn't scare people away from me, Spin. You befriended me when no one else paid me any attention.
Outcasts sticking together, I said, staring down at the planet, which glowed under the enormous lights moving up here. I could see the shadows and strips of brightness they made, the lights left over from a time when detritus had grown more than dust and fungus. Rig, I said softly, how bad a friend am I?
You're not.
Be straight with me, please.
I really hurt Jorgen today.
I need to hear from someone I trust. How bad am I at this?
You're not bad at being a friend, Rig said. You're just hard to be friends with. That's different.
How?
You try, he said. I know you do. You always looked out for me. Scud, I doubt you would normally have chosen the quiet, occasionally panicky guy to be your best friend. But I needed someone, and you saw others picking on me, and, well, here we are. You're loyal, passionate, and inventive.
But
you are really,
really bad at seeing things from other people's viewpoints. You just go and do stuff, Spin, and believe everyone else would have done the same thing if they'd only thought of it and had the guts.
Fair, I said. I know I pushed you into flight school, but I can't see things as if I'm someone else. I'm me. Shockingly, I see things like me.
It's a skill to practice, like any other, he said. You love stories. Maybe ask yourself, what if the story weren't about you for a change? What if it were Jorgen's story? How would he feel about what you're doing?
Scud, that hit me right in the gut. He made it sound so easy, and maybe for him it was. But I'd done what needed to be done. For Jorgen, for Detritus, and given what was happening to me, the powers I was displaying, well, what if alienating Jorgen and the others was the only way to protect them? It twisted me up inside, made me start to tremble, made me think of my friends dying, graphically, over and over in my mind. To escape those images and another potential episode, I rolled back over and snatched one of the schematics. You know, Raj, I said to him, you're a weird guy.
True, true.
I walk in here to find you lying face down among a bunch of pieces of paper.
You immediately flop down beside me.
Practicing empathy, I said. What is all of this?
Detritus has several enormous shipyards among these platforms, he said.
Yeah, I know, I said. I had a battle in one, remember?
Right, while it was crashing. Ned's brothers...
I nodded, though he couldn't see, as he was still face down. Yeah, he really was weird. Maybe we had always been destined to become friends. You think you can build me a ship with one of these fabrication plants? I asked.
Depends, really, he said. Do you have designs for what you'd want? And by that, I mean accurate, detailed schematics created by an actual engineer. Not something hand-drawn on a scrap of paper, depicting a catapult for launching Stacy Leftwire into a furnace.
I smiled. I forgot about that.
I didn't. You wrote it in blood.
Rat blood, I agreed. It makes a terrible ink. Kept congealing. Not sure how the old necromancers ever made use of it in their arcane tomes.
Can we change the topic?
I'll get you schematics, I said. Real ones. They were in the data dump we stole.
Great, he said. I wanted to do some tests anyway. Been thinking, though, that we don't really need more fighters. We have plenty for our trained pilots. Maybe we need something else.
I myself wasn't so certain we had all the fighters we needed. Now that we had a hyperslug ejection system for pilots, we might start chewing through ships faster. It was a mindset change. We'd always had ejection systems that worked in atmosphere, but the culture of the DDF had trained pilots to protect their ships, ostensibly harder to replace, over their own lives. I often wondered how much that short-sightedness had cost us. We hadn't acknowledged the importance of skilled veteran pilots. Half the reason my friends and I were in such high positions was the fact that we'd managed to survive long enough to actually get some useful combat experience. I was about to explain to Rig what I wanted him to fabricate when the door swung open and FM strode in. She was faintly flushed, tense, still poised, of course, but for FM, this was the equivalent of being in a panic. What is it? I said, immediately sitting up. Emergency conference called by command, she said. The enemy is doing something. I was looking for Raj, but Jorgen will be glad you were here too.
I wasn't so certain about that. Not today. But as Rig scrambled to gather his schematics, I stood up.
Do you know anything more?
Yeah, she said. Shutting down the enemy's access to Acclivity Stone really got their attention.
And? She said, meeting my eyes.
They're changing tactics. We can't be certain, it's probably too early to tell, but their troop movements indicate... Well, they've realized they can't win a long war as easily as they could have before. So instead...
Instead? I frowned, trying to think what I would do in their situation. They would realize we were going to try to bleed them over time, but they still had vastly superior numbers. So in their place, I'd...
Scud.
Chapter 17.
All-out assault!
Goro, one of the Kitsune generals, said, hovering his platform over to a wall screen and gesturing at the footage we'd been able to gather from across the superiority. Hyperslugs let us jump ground teams in to spy on the installations Kuna had identified for us.
Again,
Goro said, hovering to another part of the wall screen, then pointing to a different image.
We aren't certain, but this is what it looks like. Makes sense, unfortunately,
Cobb said.
He still refused to sit at the table with us, instead taking an advisor's seat by the wall. The pallor of his skin and bags under his eyes had me worried about him, but he did seem to be participating more, so maybe he was getting better.
They understand our strategy, Cobb continued. Over time, if we destroy their military in little skirmishes, piece by piece, they could lose control.
Right now, the superiority is stable, Kuna added from their spot at the table. It's large enough and has enough momentum that few of the common citizens will have noticed anything changing since the advent of Winzik's reign. However, we are not Cathodis. My translator pin, set to explain things like this, whispered it was a metaphor for an object that sits on a wall and watches the world pass, never moving. A little like the English phrase, we aren't sheep.
Over time, Kuna continued, people will grow increasingly upset at the loss of democracy. They will see through Winzik's rhetoric about dangerous humans and delvers, and they will ask questions. If we're destroying his military presence, the more rambunctious of the lesser species might rebel against his rule. Even those of primary intelligence will begin to move against him.
Without his supply depots, Winzik has realized that a long-term engagement against us has grown more risky,
Goro agreed. He gestured toward more footage on the screen.
So, here we see him pulling security forces away from the planet Uklar, and here, others away from the planet Ziptok. Here he is calling in ships that were protecting important sublight shipping lanes in the Dion twin system from piracy. They're gathering. If he is aggressive in these redeployments, he can bring in some 2,700 fighters to support his primary fleet. About a third of those will have actual in-cockpit pilots, while the rest are remote drones. Worse, he has access to 20 to 30 capital ships, 8 carriers, and twice as many destroyers.
Scud, those numbers. 2,700 fighters? Even with our allies, we had barely 300. Yes, a good chunk of theirs would be drones, which were much easier to face. But our force of 300 included all of our newer recruits and trainees, who had barely any battle experience. And as always, we had no capital ships. Though granted, Detritus itself was a giant moving battle station. Most of our forces were raiders, the modern equivalent of cavalry. We'd survived so far by being fast, striking where Winzik didn't expect, and, to be perfectly frank, exploiting the fact that he couldn't devote much of his attention to us. He was busy establishing himself as galactic dictator. This was coming to a head, though. He couldn't afford to let us keep picking at him. We'd served our purpose, giving him a boogeyman to use as proof he needed dictatorial authority. Now he would want a decisive battle where he destroyed us outright. If he couldn't win the long war, that was his only other option. Squash us fast. I should have seen this.
Wait,
Rinnakeen said from his seat at the table, a confused expression on his pale violet face.
Won't this risk rebellion? If Winzik moves all of his security forces away from his planets, won't those planets turn against him?
Eventually, yes, Kuna said. This is a possible problem. But you must understand, we're not, aggressive, I asked. I was looking for a less charged term, they said. I've learned it might not be as accurate a word as I would have liked,
But in this case, perhaps it will serve. We're not aggressive. We aren't cathodous, and will not just sit forever and be content with oppression. At the same time, my people, and those they lead, will try other methods first. Bills to enforce the law, motions in governing bodies, editorials in the media. Winzik will need his military forces then, if these movements gain strength. But he has likely seen, and rightly so, that he can spare the forces now, for a short time.
For just long enough to make slag out of us, Jorgen said grimly.
Did you foresee this? Rinnakeen asked, looking to Jorgen. In your plan to starve him of acclivity stone?
This was poorly handled,
Goro said, hovering toward the group of other kitsen gathered on the tabletop.
Elder Ichika and I are greatly displeased to have been cut out of the decision to strike in secret against the enemy. Why weren't we consulted about moving the time frame up so quickly, or the decision to strike in the nowhere, instead of against the facilities in the somewhere, as we'd decided?
How can we call this an alliance, Kuna said, if one of our members acts with such distrust toward everyone else? I sank down in my seat, sick to my stomach. Jorgen would never have moved up the attack without talking to our allies. His hot-headed star pilot, though, was another matter. Scott, I was such a fool. Jorgen stood up and didn't even glance at me. He'd shoulder this, as he so often suffered because of me. Everything I'd done seemed right, even in hindsight. Refurbishing Embot, running off to Starsight, staying in the nowhere. Even this action, which had achieved our goals with the mining facilities without loss of life. Yet in each case, I'd left Jorgen to make excuses, to pick up the pieces, to figure out how to lead while I just did my thing. He was right about me. In that moment, I felt I didn't deserve to be in that seat. I didn't even deserve to be in the room.
No, Rinnakeen, Jorgen said to them. I didn't anticipate that this would happen. You're right. And Goro, you are right that we have acted brashly by not consulting you. We were wrong, and I beg your forgiveness. We're new to this. That's the problem, my friends, too new. We are children, essentially, trying to fill adult shoes for the first time. My people spent decades on the very edge of annihilation. Back then, we didn't take time to develop proper plans, because if we did, we'd be dead before we could execute them. That same sense rules us still, that sense of panic, that sense that we need to act now, as soon as an opportunity arises, lest we lose our chance. We need to grow up. We need to learn and do better. But I only ask that you accept that we are not trying to alienate you. We're learning all the time, and as fast as we can.
The others at the table considered his words, and I could see them softening. How did Jorgen always know the right things to say? How did he know when to be firm and when to apologize? The others saw him shouldering the responsibility for what I'd done, and they accepted his apology.
I suppose we can understand this, Goro said. None of us have ever fought a truly galactic war. Even on my homeworld, it has been decades since a real war has happened. We have known only skirmishes.
You can be forgiven, Rinnakeen agreed, for not anticipating what would happen in a war on this scale. We are all new to this, and the plan with the mining stations looked good to us all. We would not be nearly so upset if we'd simply been told when you decided to move the timetable up.
We promise, Jorgen said, finally looking at me. No more surprises. We will grow up, my friends.
A platform hovered up beside Goro's. Ichika, the aged kitsen with white on her snout, still wore her formal robes. She was an elected official, I'd come to understand. Not like an empress, they'd moved beyond that, but still something of a voice for the old ways.
We too appreciate your honesty, Admiral, she said to Jorgen. But there is a beast we must consume, as my people say. A topic that must be addressed.
Our planet, Evershore, is exposed, as is Redon, the homeworld of our allies, the Urdale. Your people, however, have a mobile planet with a defensive shell around it. You can afford brashness, for if the enemy comes in force, you can escape. We cannot. Our people could be annihilated. The conference room fell silent, and I felt even more sick, because this point also was true. I wasn't used to the idea of our people being free, like Jorgen had explained, but I didn't believe that was what had driven me to act. That didn't change the fact that, yes, if the superiority came in force against us, we could escape. Detritus being mobile meant that our people were actually more free than any other.
We couldn't escape forever, Jorgen said. Winzik cannot allow us to continue as a threat to his rule. Besides, we wouldn't just leave you.
Rinnakeen tapped the table softly, perhaps his version of clearing his throat to draw attention.
No one is accusing you of cowardice, Admiral. But if it came down to your people or ours, surely you would escape. It is a simple truth. I say this not as an accusation, but as a statement we should acknowledge. Detritus is not in the same position as the rest of us.
Besides, Kuna noted, you're humans. You're used to living with destruction and war. Remarkably, the Urdale and the Kitson seemed to agree, unfair though the statement was. I didn't think humans were naturally more aggressive. We'd just been... I didn't know how to describe it. A soft click sounded from the side of the room, then a quiet groan as somebody stood up. A short somebody, bowed by age.
Gran-Gran?
Another click echoed in the conference room as she stepped forward along the table. The way she walked, frail but determined, somehow conveyed the contradiction at the core of Gran-Gran's soul. An aged woman, weak of frame, yet bearing power and authority. On one hand, she was a nobody, an old woman, outcast for most of her life because of her son's betrayal. Except even back then, people had stepped aside for her. Even then, they'd known and remembered. She wasn't just Gran-Gran. She was Rebecca Nightshade, the last living woman who knew life among the stars, the last crew member of the ship that had brought us here.
"Do you know," she asked, "the story of the Defiant?"
She turned, her eyes closed, yet seeming to address everyone in the room, Kitson, Urdale, human, and lone Dione.
"We do not know your story, honored elder," Hesho said softly behind his mask from where he hovered near my seat. "But I would hear it if you would offer it to me."
Gran-Gran smiled and tilted her face upward toward the stars as she walked.
"We are the people who disobeyed. We are the humans who would not go to war. The last time the tyrants who led our various peoples banded together and tried to conquer the galaxy. Those are the warriors under whom you, Urdale, suffered long ago. Well, those humans, they demanded that every battle-worthy ship join the Armada and support them in their foolish war. But we turned away. Some of us of Chinese descent, others Colombian, others American, others Scandinavian, and many scattered peoples between. We had previously traded together, traveled together, but on that day we truly became one. A wise soldier chooses her battlefield, and we did not want this one. We rejected the call to arms, and so the first people we defied were our own leaders. That is the soul of the Defiant. It is not just that we fight, my friends. It is that we choose when to fight. We will not be forced, not by tide nor tyrant, to raise arms in a battle we do not support.
She opened her eyes, milky white, and looked around the room in strength.
But once we do fight, once you have convinced us the cause is just,
We do not back down.
She stopped near the kits and platforms. There, Gran-Gran nodded, chin still high.
We will not abandon you, my friends. I, the last of the Defiance crew, swear it. If you fall, we shall join you, so that together we may curse the fire and ash that sear our flesh from our bones. Dead, but not broken. If we instead choose to run, as my ancestors did, then we will only do so if we can bring you with us. For though we are not one people, as we unite together, we become sisters in arms. You do not fight alone.
Though I'd heard this story of our origins many times before, it still brought a tear to my eyes. Gran-Gran's words were nearly enough to pull me out of my gloom, and, although she had a uniquely nightshade way of phrasing things, the speech had a positive effect on our allies. The Kitsin stood down, accepting this promise. The others seemed comforted and calmed. Another Spensa crisis averted. Scud. The speech wouldn't have been needed if I hadn't made everyone panic about humans acting erratically. The glow of hearing Gran-Gran speak faded, and the weight of my mistakes came crashing back down on me. Jorgen thanked Gran-Gran, then addressed the table.
We can adapt to the enemy's new tactics, he said. Fortunately, it will take Winzik some time to prepare his forces. I suggest that we meet with our various strategic experts, go over the intel we've gathered, then reconvene tonight. 2000 local time, to share ideas.
The others agreed. The meeting began to break apart, and I fled through the doors, ignoring Kimmelin's suggestion that we grab breakfast together. I didn't want to argue again with Jorgen, and I didn't want to face my friends. I wanted to be alone. I was more and more certain that was where I belonged.